You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a walk in,
hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal, and I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. We are going to talk today about kind of a scattering of fairly specialized topics that even 20 years ago wouldn't have been considered super specialized. For example, the Cold War is in an interesting cultural space for Americans today, kind of between the open embrace of socialism by some and the branding of all opponents as communists by others. As we get farther and farther away from our tensions with the Soviet Union and our wars with other communist nations like North Korea and North Vietnam, it can be difficult to have a balanced view of the major conflict of the second half of the 20th century. And if my students are typical, it's a view that not many of them have. In the same way, it can be a challenge to remember some of the controversies religiously from the beginning of the 20th century, the modernist fundamentalist controversy, controversies over evolution and its role in the intellectual life of the church, and numerous other things that are, even if we're still having discussions about the same topics, that specific time period is no longer necessarily on our radar. To help us see where all of these things come together, or at least one of the places where all of these things come together, today we have joining us on the show John Wilsey, Associate Professor of Church History at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, where he lives with his wife Mandy and his children Carolyn and Sally. Dr. Wilsey, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Coyle. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, well, I'm excited about this book. So the book we're talking about is God's Cold Warrior, The Life and Faith of John Foster Dulles. Now, Dulles, you'll have to help me with the year. Dulles died in 1959, is that right?
That's right. That's right.
So he has been off the scene for more than 60 years at this point. I'm willing to bet that that the number of people on my campus who've heard of him is you know, in the maybe 100 range and almost exclusively faculty. So why don't you give us an intro to this guy? Who was John Foster Dulles, and why should we read a book about him?
Well, yeah, it's always kind of amazing to me when I think about how few people have heard of John Foster Dulles. And I talk about that amazement in the introduction to the book. I remember when I first started researching on John Foster Dulles, I was telling my mom, she wouldn't like me to tell you this, but
she will never hear this. Don't worry.
She was born in 1942. So, and I was telling her, I'm researching on John Foster Dulles. He was Secretary of State under Dwight Eisenhower. She said, I know who he was. She remembers him, you know? So
sure.
People of a certain age will remember him, of course. I had another story, interesting story. A PhD student of mine is a pastor in Indiana, and he read the book, and he gave a copy of the book to a gentleman in his church who was in his 90s. He was in World War II. He was in the Army Air Corps. Later, he had a career in the Air Force. And he said, I'd like to give you this book. I think you'd be interested in it. And he took the book, and he saw the cover, and he said, ah, Mr. Dulles. And he told me that story, and the fact that this man referred to him as Mr. Dulles was extremely significant to me, because that's exactly how everybody would have referred to him back in those days. So it's almost like in that one little brief instant of him saying, ah, Mr. Dulles, you know, it's almost it transports you back into the 50s just to hear him say that. So there are a number of people, you know, of a certain age that remember him. But you're right. I mean, most people, when I tell them I'm writing this book or this book has come out. Now, was he the guy that ran the CIA, or was he the spy master? Didn't he work for the NSA? Or
right. The Catholic cardinal. You know.
Yeah. Or yes. I get that a lot, too. In seminary circles, people think I'm talking about Avery. Doesn't he have an airport or something named after him? So John Foster Dulles was Secretary of State from 1953 to 1959. And he was, during that time, you know, he was, I would say, certainly after 1956, after the Suez Crisis of 1956, John Foster Dulles is the most powerful diplomat on the world stage. Until his retirement and death, he retired in April, and he died in May because he had an aggressive form of abdominal cancer. So he was, I mean, he was a colossus that bestrode world diplomacy in the Cold War. You know, in the free world, what was known then as the free world, I still use that term, having grown up in the 80s and 70s.
Sure.
In the free world, you know, especially after 1956, you know, no country would have made really any move without a nod from Dulles. And the man was just the man was extremely powerful. Eisenhower trusted him implicitly. He didn't leave all foreign policy questions to Dulles, but he did trust him very deeply. And they had a partnership that was sort of historic.
Now, I appreciate anything else you want to say about background? I guess I don't want
to. No, I think that's sufficient for just to get us going, get the machinery lubed.
Yeah, no, all of that is obviously true, but it's not really the point of your book, right? You don't go into the nuts and bolts of that. So what is your take on Dulles, and what is your contribution to Dulles's biography?
Well, I got interested in Dulles when I wrote that book, American Exceptionalism and Civil Religion, about 5 years ago, and I wrote a chapter about John Foster Dulles, and the context of that chapter was American mission. You know, the belief that God chose America for a particular mission in the world. And I used Dulles as a sort of paradigmatic figure. I looked at Dulles and his times as an example of, you know, how America thought of itself in the world and how America believed it had a mission in the world. And for, you know, Dulles believed that the United States was, as a Christian nation, was chosen by God to confront communism and to defeat communism.
Now, are you saying that's not the case?
That is the case.
No, I mean, are you saying that God didn't choose the United States to defeat communism?
Well, you know, as a historian, I try not to embrace a particular viewpoint, but that, you know, that was definitely the view. You know, the 50s represented a sort of an awakening of civil religion, and Dulles was both a contributor to that awakening and also a product of that awakening at the same time. So I talk about those things in American Exceptionalism, and I got interested in Dulles, and I just, you know, thought, gosh, it would be great to learn more about him. And along the way, I decided to, hey, I think I'm going to propose a religious biography of him. So where do these beliefs come from? Like, you know, he saw himself as chosen by God for the mission of leading the United States to fulfill its mission in the world in the 50s. Where do these things come from? You know, he's a very religious man. He had a very sharply articulated religious worldview that he brought with him into the office of Secretary of State. You know, he's situated in that civil religious awakening of the 1950s. And yeah, I said, I'd like to know more about his intellectual development, his moral development, his religious development. And I'm not a diplomatic historian. I'm not a Cold War historian. I'm a religious historian. And so this is a religious biography. And it just sort of fit really well, too, it seemed to me, and I hope it does, to fit really well into that religious biography series. Where, you know, the focus of these books in that series that Urbans did, they're not focused on, like, you know, the Robert E. Lee book is not really focused on him as generalship. It's focused on his worldview. And the Abraham Lincoln is focused mainly on his, you know, it's more of an intellectual biography. So that's what I wanted to do, too, is really kind of look at his worldview, How did it develop? And then as a historiographical concern, also to think about Dulles as a human being, instead of just, you know, in sort of abstract terms or as a diplomat or as a secretary of state or a high official in the United States government or as an American exceptionalist or something like that. You know, this was a man. He lived a full life. He had a wife. He had children. He had relationships with them. He had brothers and sisters. He had parents that loved him, just like you and me. And so how do we, as Christians, how do we assess a life lived, a life that was morally complex? You know, he did a lot of good things. He also contributed in a lot of ways to some evil things and everything in between. So how do we consider a life like that as Christians? What is our responsibility as Christian historians towards the dead? And that's a primary theme I want to follow as well.
And can you talk a little bit about Dulles's religious sensibility? So when I hear 50s awakening of civil religion, right, I might think Billy Graham. I might mm-hmm. think Bob Jones. Uh-huh. I might even think, if I'm a regular listener to my own show, which I'm not because that sounds awful, but if I were to go back and listen, I might think an interview we did with Paul Matsko a few episodes back on the talk radio of the 1950s, and people like Carl McIntyre and Billy yeah. James Hargis. Where does Dulles's religious sensibility line up next to our other kind of stereotypical 1950s religious civic thinkers?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, so Dulles grew up a pastor's kid. He was the oldest son, the oldest child of Alan Macy Dulles, who was a pastor, a Presbyterian pastor in, first he was a pastor in Michigan before Dulles was, John Foster Dulles was born, and then when Foster was born, he was pastoring a church in upstate New York, in Watertown, New York, First Presbyterian Church of Watertown. And he was the pastor of that church for 17 years. And then he went on and was a theologian. He was a professor of theism and apologetics at Auburn Seminary in Auburn, New York. So he grew up, you know, in the late 19th century, you know, first couple of years of the 20th, in the context of, you know, North Country Presbyterian liberalism. His father was, you know, Alan Macy was a liberal. He was educated in Europe and educated in higher criticism and very much focused on Christian ethics. This was the driving force of Christianity, not doctrine, not theology, but ethics. You know, fatherhood of God, brotherhood of man type of Christianity. Dulles grew up steeped in that, going to church, you know, listening to three sermons every Sunday, very devout family, very religious family. They would come home on Sundays. They would gather around the piano and sing hymns all afternoon. They would recite scripture. They would have a huge Sunday dinner as a family. It was all, you know, it was just this week after week after week kind of patterns, religious patterns, lifestyle patterns. Foster was one of five children, and this is what he grew up with and grew up in. And then, but he has that North Country sort of provincial, you know, world that he lives in. But he also, on the other hand, his grandfather on his mother's side had been Secretary of State under Benjamin Harrison. John Foster was his name. John Foster Dulles was named after him. And the Fosters lived in Washington, D.C. So, you know, for a significant of his a portion of his life, he spent in that world, in the world of Washington, D.C. His grandfather was also Presbyterian. So there was no it was sort of a seamless religious life between his maternal side and his paternal side. And, you know, they. You know, in their family, they emphasized Christian duty towards one's fellow man above just about everything else. So that's kind of the world that he grew up in, and he carried that with him all of his life. And by the time, you know, you get to the 50s, you know, Dulles is in his 60s. And it's, it, you know, after World War II, the Cold War begins, you know, in 1947, after the Berlin airlift, it's pretty obvious that there's a Cold War occurring. And during the Cold War, the idea that the Soviet Union and communism was godless. And that contrasted with the United States, which was founded as a Christian nation, you know, founded on Christian principles. Not kind of the same kind of Christian nationalism that we see running around now, right? But more of a Christian nationalism that is informed by ideas. You know, it was individual rights, human liberty, dignity of human beings, equality under the law. These were consistent with Christian principles, and indeed they were Christian principles to John Foster Dulles. The civil religious awakening, you know, some of the things that are associated with that. The phrase "one nation under God," under God being added to the Pledge of Allegiance in 1954. Eisenhower was the first president to be baptized in office. He was baptized by Edward L. R. Elson of the National Presbyterian Church. Eisenhower successfully advocated for the phrase "under God" to be added to the pledge. And in 1956, you know, the United States adopted as its motto, "In God We Trust." Eisenhower was sort of seen, this is an argument that Richard Pierard made in his book, Civil Religion and the Presidency. He argued that Eisenhower was something of a pastor to the United States, to Americans, and was viewed that way. In the sense that he was like this elder statesman, you know, that he was this wise man who had seen the horrors of war and was sort of presiding over a United States that had been victorious in World War II, but now it faces this great existential challenge, the greatest challenge that the United States had ever faced in its history. And it's almost like the United States came to be and came into existence for this moment, you know, for such a time as this, to confront global communism that is godless and is being directed by, you know, the power brokers in Moscow. Well, Dulles buys into all this, and he also talks about it all the time. I mean, his speeches, his formal speeches, and also his remarks at press conferences, his, you know, pieces that he writes, interviews that he gives, are always just hitting on this theme of godless communism. And it is our duty to the world to roll communism back, to liberate the 800 million, as he said, the 800 million people that are held captive by communism. So I don't know if that answers your question. I'm kind of going on and on here, but
No. This is great. I'll save my own commentary. I could hear more. I stand to hear more of that language these days. But you mentioned that Dulles is kind of raised in the theological liberal Presbyterian tradition, and that gets translated into civic virtue.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want to talk about the policy of that. But before we get to Dulles's policy, especially in the 40s and 50s. You make the case in the book that he is not terribly theologically reflective, and I don't want to exactly push back on that, but I want to ask. How can I say this? He's not sitting around, you know, sort of thinking the big questions, right? Or dealing, you know, mulling over substitutionary atonement or anything like that. But he does get down into the weeds of some of the theological arguments going on in the Presbyterian Church that will eventually lead to, eventually, I think after Dulles, I'm not up on my Presbyterian history, but it'll eventually lead to the split between the PCUSA and the PCA. Can you talk to us a little bit about his involvement in the early days of that conflict?
Oh, man. And that is like... That is a super fun period of his life.
Right. where he's clearly dealing with the issues, even if he's not wading into the weeds of theology. I guess what I'm wanting to say is he's not a religious novice, and he's not just shooting from the hip, even if he's utterly uninterested in deep theology.
So the Presbyterian fundamentalist modernist controversy, it's an old controversy. It doesn't start in the 1920s, but
right.
In 1922, the fundamentalist modernist controversy is ignited, and Dulles gets involved in the context of Harry Emerson Fosdick's sermon that he preached at the First Presbyterian Church of New York in Manhattan, Old First. You know, he preached that sermon, Shall the Fundamentalists Win? He preached that sermon on May 21st, 1922. For Fosdick, the fundamentalists, were conservatives in Protestantism, questioning Darwin's evolutionary theory, questioning higher criticism of the Bible. And Fosdick, he preached from Acts 5, 38 through 39. And attacks the fundamentalists for wishing to, force the Presbyterian, force the liberals out of the Presbyterian church. And the sermon, he was a guest preacher. He was a permanent guest preacher at Old First, and he had been for a few years. So he had preached, just like every pastor. I mean, he preached sermon, Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, he's preaching. But this particular sermon made waves because a man named Ivy Lee, who was a fellow liberal Presbyterian with Fosdick, and he was sort of a public relations pioneer, he asked Fosdick if he would, hey, do you want to have your sermon printed and have it distributed to a mass audience? And Fosdick said, yeah, that'd be great. 130,000 copies were produced. Ivy Lee got funding from John D. Rockefeller Jr. And so it made a splash because it had been mass produced. It's kind of like in the Reformation days, John Huss's ideas don't really get past Bohemia, but Luther, because of the printing press, he's a sensation all over Central Europe, all over Europe. So something similar to that. Well, almost immediately after Fosdick delivers this sermon, a fundamentalist pastor named Clarence McCartney preached a rebuttal sermon called "Shall Unbelief Win?" And this is going to launch the controversy as Dulles got involved with it in the 20s. Now, Dulles was sent to the General Assembly in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in 1923. And 1924, rather. He was elected to serve as a commissioner to the General Assembly in Grand Rapids in 1924. And he went, and he, Dulles actually had direct dealings with William Jennings Bryan, at the General Assembly.
Himself an interesting figure in this whole.
Oh, gosh, yes. Very a fascinating figure in this whole thing. William Jennings Bryan having been, nominated by the Democratic Party for the presidency three times,
yeah.
1896, 1900, 1908. He had been Secretary of State, of course, under Woodrow Wilson, resigned after the sinking of the Lusitania. But Dulles is serving as counsel, legal counsel to Fosdick before the Permanent Judicial Commission of the Presbyterian Church. Because the issue was the fundamentalists wanted to get rid of him. They wanted to, toss him out of the church and be done with him. He was a Baptist after all. So the Judicial Commission finally found, after a year that, well, since, Fosdick, you're a Baptist, why don't you just become a Presbyterian and they can hire you on as the lead pastor, as the main pastor of Old First. They were, The Judicial Commission ultimately was mostly concerned with him being a Baptist, not with the sermon itself. And at that point, Fosdick said no, and he resigned from Old First and ended up going to be a pastor in the church. But So that was sort of phase one. I call this phase one of Dulles's involvement. Phase two and phase three, you know, the modernists are engaged in disputes over the recognizing the legitimacy of ministers or ministerial candidates who did not affirm the virgin birth. So there were a number of individuals who were undergoing examination for licensure who denied the virgin birth. The most prominent of these people was Henry Pitt Van Dusen, Henry Pitney Van Dusen, who ended up becoming the president of Union Theological Seminary. They were in Van Dusen and Dulles became very good friends in their lives. And Dulles had a particularly interesting way of navigating that dispute. Fundamentalists, of course, they wanted to make that a theological point. These people were denying the virgin birth. They were denying, substitutionary atonement of Christ and so forth. And that's the reason why they should not be granted licensure or ordination.
Right.
But Dulles was not going. He counseled. He was legal counsel in these disputes. His strategy was not to address the doctrinal issues. His strategy was to address these questions from a constitutional vantage point. So,
constitutional meaning Presbyterian
exactly.
governing documents, right? Not like U.S. Constitution.
Yeah. So, if you don't mind, let me just read you a brief section to illustrate this point.
Go for it.
The New York Presbytery's constitutional authority to license was original under the form of government. The General Assembly did not have the power to enforce belief in the 5 points. The 5 points were a doctrinal deliverance from 1915, basically affirming the 5 points of fundamentalism, historicity of miracles, inspiration of scripture, substitutionary atonement, physical resurrection of Christ, and the inerrancy of scripture. The brief filed by the modernists stated, quote, the Constitution, Presbyterian Constitution, form of government, not theology, is the source from which the validity of this assertion must be traced. The theological soundness of the doctrinal deliverances of 1910 and 1916, that is the 5 points, is not in issue. Whether sound or unsound, the attempt to make them or any other doctrinal deliverances of the General Assembly a part of the church's fundamental law would be, if successful, a complete reversal of historic Presbyterianism and would eventuate in church anarchy. This is not heresy. It is orthodox constitutionalism. So that is Dulles's approach. It is a legal approach. It's a constitutional approach, not a doctrinal or a dogmatic approach. And what that had the effect of doing, it took the initiative away from the fundamentalists, and it took sort of the logical high ground away from the fundamentalists, which they had held before. You know, George Morrison, when he wrote in his book on the fundamentalists in the early 20th century, he points out that prior to 1925, the fundamentalists had the upper hand logically. Like, look, if you don't believe these things, then you need to leave. I mean, that's just as simple as that. But in shifting the debate away from doctrine and theology and more towards form of government and constitutionalism, now the modernists could claim the logical high ground.
Right, and that's the tricky response, right? It technically, theologically, the fundamentalists are clearly right. You can't be a Christian and not believe the five things you listed. I think that's generally true. But
yeah.
if you because those things are not already included in the governing documents, if you say, hey, these are now the standard, then that's just going to empower whoever's making the biggest noise to keep adding to.
Yeah,
the rules, to keep basically changing the rules so that they always win, and that's also clearly unjust.
Absolutely, absolutely. So by the time Dulles has finished his role in the controversy, and that's by 1926. So his his involvement goes from 1924 through 26 in the Presbyterian controversy. And, you know, it's a stunning success for the modernists. I mean, Dulles plays a role. I mean, he's not the only person, right? But Dulles plays a central, significant role in setting the PCUSA on a modernist trajectory. Because it's, you know, it's in the subsequent years that you have the formation of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church under, you know, J. Gresham Machen, formation of Westminster Seminary, so forth and so on. And all that comes out of this business with Harry Emerson Fosdick, and also the question about the ordination over the and the theological disputes over the Five Points. So Dulles is he is not a deep theological thinker, and indeed, when he is involved in the controversy, he's not playing on theological grounds. I mean, he doesn't. He himself is skeptical of the virgin birth. He's skeptical of the inerrancy of Scripture. He's a modernist. But for him, doctrine is not the issue. And that says a lot about his theological reflection. I mean, Dulles in his career, he was an attorney. He was the managing partner of Sullivan and Cromwell from 1926 all the way to 1949. He was a corporate attorney. That's what his career was. And when he goes into the controversy, he goes in as an attorney. He doesn't go into it as a theologian.
Right. Which is interesting because his term as Secretary of State and shaping of American foreign policy, certainly not unrelated to him being an attorney, but
absolutely,
he is very dogmatic, right, in those roles.
Now, he is very dogmatic, yes.
So can you talk a little bit then about how that untheologically reflective kind of practical religious sensibility gets translated into America's foreign policy as Dulles takes more and more of a role on the national stage?
Yes, and you know, that's a big question. There's a lot to it, but
sure,
I can't.
Yeah, give us the highlights, and people can read the book and get the details.
Absolutely, they can read the book. But the short answer to the question is, Dulles has the one thing that Dulles. Let me back up. The one transcendent sort of doctrinal point that Dulles is very interested in and is very dogmatic about is this idea about God's moral law. And the moral law for Dulles, again, he is a comes out of a liberal Presbyterian tradition. So moral law, it's not quite the same as like what we might call natural law in the Catholic tradition. The moral law is that, you know, God creates the universe as a moral system. And justice, righteousness, you know, truth, freedom, Dulles would certainly include freedom in these virtues. These things are built into the order of things. And, you know, by God's transcendent creative work. That's, you know, and that's reflective of his theological position as a liberal. He puts all the emphasis on Christianity as an operational faith, an ethical faith, not just like an intellectual faith or a doctrinal faith, right? It is operative. It is active. And the moral law is when we engage in the ethic of Jesus, you know, which is going to be, you know, articulated in like the Golden Rule, passages like greater love hath no man than this, and he laid down his life for his friends. These kinds of moral principles that Jesus had, forgive those who, you know, despitefully use you, turn the other cheek. I mean, all these things are in the Sermon on the Mount. These are all the ethic of Jesus, and these are the sort of, you know, practical teachings of the moral law. But these things are built into the universe. And a nation, just like a church, has a duty and obligation to God to embrace the moral law, to champion and defend the moral law, and to advance it. And the United States, given the fact that it is the It is a Christian nation founded on the principles of the moral law, Christian principles. And, you know, having defeated the Nazis, having defeated Japanese expansionism, was in a position of power that was unprecedented in the world and was the only nation that could stand up to this godless, tyrannical super state that was absolutely bent upon destroying freedom and destroying everything that was worth living for in the world. The Soviet Union had denied the moral law and set itself outside of the moral law, and there was no possible way that the Soviets could win. God was going to ultimately prevail, and he would prevail over this horrible threat through those nations that embraced the moral law, led by the United States.
Right. So how then does this this idea of the U.S. following the moral law, right, pursuing what's right in the world according to, you know, divine ordination, how does that translate into specific policies like the Korean War or brinksmanship, right? That's the name for Dulles's famous policy. How do we get from one of those to the other when at least I didn't see an obvious, you know, straight line connection there, although in the moment, of course, you can maybe see how that works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, there's lots of different ways I could answer that question, lots of different policies and different contexts.
Right. Talk about. So and again, get the book, listener, for the
right?
for the whole picture.
Go get the book. You'll enjoy the book. But I think the one example that is most fascinating to me is something that is an episode in Dulles's life that occurs before he was Secretary of State. And that is with the finalization of war with Japan and the signing of the Treaty of San Francisco in 1952. As you know, the war was over with. You know, the Japanese signed the surrender agreement on the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay on September 2nd, 1945. But, you know, the war is technically, diplomatically not really over, right? The hostilities are completed, but formally, the United States is still in a state of war with Japan until the signing of the peace treaty in 1952, the Treaty of San Francisco. Well, between 1945 and 1952, Japan was under American occupation, right? Under the command of Douglas MacArthur, who was, the commander of all Allied forces in the Pacific. So, you know, in the years of the 40s, MacArthur was more and more convinced that, you know, the longer you have an occupation force, the more embittered the population of the country is going to be. I mean, you see this all through history. Certainly, MacArthur was saying, we're already seeing signs of this now. We need to have a peace treaty. We need to end the occupation. We need to have a peace treaty. Well, what's so fascinating about this, Coyle, is I mean, like, Dulles in American history is such a fascinating figure because the man shows up everywhere. The man is Forrest Gump when it comes to American history, you know, in the late 19th and early 20th century, man. I mean, he just shows up everywhere in the most unexpected places. So Dulles was actually at the, you know, he was on the Reparations Commission at the Treaty of Versailles, you know. He was in Europe. He was... you know, with the American delegation led by Woodrow Wilson, you know, hammering out the Treaty of Versailles in 1919. The man was everywhere. And one of the things that he learned and that he wrote about and thought about, you know, for the next 20 years, 25 years, was, hey, you know, Woodrow Wilson's ideas that he articulated in the 14 points would have worked had they been tried. Versailles was a failure because it was a repudiation of Wilson's vision. And what we need to do is we need to reinvigorate that vision in a way that doesn't start another world war, right? So Dulles knew, just like everybody else at the time who was a thoughtful person, that Versailles was the reason why you had World War II. So he didn't want to repeat the same mistake of Versailles. his vision, man, in this treaty, which is so cool, so fascinating, his vision for the Treaty of San Francisco, and Dulles was appointed by President Truman to be the lead negotiator on the Treaty of San Francisco. And he had ambassadorial rank, and he answered only to the Secretary of State and the President. So he had almost absolute authority, right, in crafting this treaty. And he did the work of crafting the treaty from 1950 through all the way through the spring of 1952. His vision for this treaty was, this treaty needs to be a treaty of reconciliation, magnanimity, and forgiveness. Christian forgiveness, right? The war is over. The Japanese have been defeated. They have surrendered. They are prostrate before us. And our duty, our Christian duty to these people, is to lift them up, put them back on firm ground, treat them as equals in the community of nations. When we have the treaty negotiations, to treat them as equals, not as a defeated power. We are going to establish a relationship that is based on Christian reconciliation, not just between the United States and Japan, but all 47 other signatories to the treaty. It's absolutely remarkable. And he does this because he believes that this is what the moral law dictates. The ethic of Jesus is the moral law that God created the world, you know, as a system, moral system. And we're going to recognize that. We're going to champion that. Now, where the rubber hits the road on that, the Soviets, right? The Cold War has begun, and the Soviet threat is obvious. So Dulles views the Soviets and the Chinese communists, which, of course, had come into power in 1949 in China. So, of course, the Korean War is raging at the same time. And the Korean War is, hey, Exhibit A about how, you know, the stakes of our, you know, failure or success in this treaty. The communists are outside the moral law. And so the communists, you know, they need to be isolated by this treaty. They're going to be isolated by the treaty between the treaty of peace that is going to set Japan up as a free nation, an independent nation, one that will be protected from, you know, naked aggression from the communists, but also covert subversion by the communists. Japan and the United States will be in a mutual security relationship, but not just Japan. The Philippines, Australia, and New Zealand. There will be treaties of collective security between the United States and all these nations as well, to again isolate the communists who are outside of the moral law, and to prevent them from gaining any kind of foothold in the Eastern Pacific, in the Eastern Pacific world. And all of this, his whole vision is predicated upon the moral law.
And how does that lead to not just, of course, containment is kind of the background for what you were describing there,
right,
at the end, but not just containment and saying, yeah, if a nation wants to go communist, it can go communist, but a more aggressive resistance. How do we get from where we're just going to stop communism from spreading because we believe in this moral law, I think that's reasonable, to where we're actively going to start pushing back?
Yeah, and that was a controversial thing with Dulles, because when he's doing all this with the Treaty of San Francisco, leading these negotiations, he's doing so under the authority of a Democratic administration. So he's not criticizing that policy of containment. But when Eisenhower runs for president in 1952, Dulles is the author of the Republican platform. And the Republican platform is going to critique containment and replace it with a policy of rollback. Dulles believed that it was immoral for the United States to simply allow the lines to fall where they were, and to, abandon these captive peoples behind the Iron Curtain to their fate, right? So he believed that America had a moral responsibility to roll communism back, to liberate these captive peoples in Eastern Europe, in Korea, and in China, not just hold the line, but to roll them back, and also in you know, to liberate the people of Russia, liberate the people of China. He didn't said again and again. He wrote a book in 1950, War or Peace, where he argues that, hey, we don't have an argument with the Russian people. The Russian people are enslaved to a system. So now that's going to be the official policy that Eisenhower will run on. But when push came to shove, for example, in Hungary in 1956, when the Soviets crushed a rebellion that was occurring there, the Hungarians were looking to the United States, thinking that the Eisenhower administration would, hey, let's get behind the doctrine of rollback. Here's your opportunity. And of course, we didn't do that. Dulles didn't want to push it with them because he didn't want to start World War III.
Right.
But
right, which then brings the other issue into play, which does. Is, as far as I can tell, completely off the radar. Nuclear weapons. Where do you the ultimate weapon sort of fit in? Where does the ultimate weapon fit into Dulles's view?
Yeah. So this is another aspect of Dulles's career that is, you know, if people know anything about Dulles, they know him about in the context of nuclear weapons. And especially in terms of the doctrine of massive retaliation and, as you said a second ago, brinksmanship. In May of 1952, he wrote a piece for Life called Life magazine called A New Foreign Policy, A Policy of Boldness. And, you know, it's a rollback type of an argument. You know, he argued that the United States was the most powerful nation in the world, had the, you know, was the freest nation in the world, had a moral obligation to these people who were enslaved. You know, that policy of boldness article kind of lays the groundwork for Eisenhower's foreign policy under New Look, right? New Look was what the official policy of the Eisenhower administration would be toward the communists, New Look. Now, furthermore, with New Look, one of the key elements of New Look was this idea of collective security. Collective security would be the best way for the free world to isolate the Soviets and the communists, to protect themselves, and to be able to meet any potential aggressive action on the part of the communists anywhere in the world at a moment's notice, right? So the United States, there's no way the United States is going to be able to meet the Soviets if they were going to make an act of aggression somewhere, right? I mean, they couldn't do it by themselves. So several treaties are established, NATO, CETO, CENTO, the Mutual Security Pact between the United States and Japan, ANZUS. All of these treaty arrangements will provide for sort of collective security, so that the idea with massive retaliation would be if the Soviets were to, or the communists were to, initiate aggression somewhere, that at the time, at the place of our choosing, through collective security arrangements, we would be able to retaliate against that aggression massively, which was meant to deter, to give the Soviets pause before they decided to initiate hostilities somewhere. And then with brinksmanship, that's going to be related to massive retaliation. A journalist by the name of James Shepley, who was the chief of Time Life Washington Bureau, he interviewed Foster to get his thoughts on, you know, massive retaliation. And when he interviewed Foster, he said he made one of the most controversial statements in his whole career. This is what Foster said. Some say that we were brought to the verge of war. This is in the context of Dien Bien Phu in 1954. Of course, we were brought to the verge of war. The ability to get to the verge without getting into war is the necessary art. If you cannot master it, you inevitably get into war. If you try to run away, you are scared to go to the brink, you're lost. We walked to the brink and we looked it in the face. So the cartoonist for the Washington Post, Herb Locke, which lots of people remember Herb Locke, I certainly do from being a kid, And I think Herblock was an active syndicated columnist for the Washington, or a syndicated cartoonist for the Washington Post all the way through the Clinton administration. But he did a famous cartoon of, you know, a pudgy John Foster Dulles dressed up in a Superman costume, pushing Uncle Sam over a cliff, and he says, "Don't worry, I can bring you back." Right.
Well, and the important thing is we avoided disaster in Vietnam as a result of that, right?
Well, yes, sort of yes and no. I mean, we avoided you know, initiating a nuclear conflagration by not supporting the French directly in Dien Bien Phu in 1954, but of course, you know, our involvement there was sort of a death by a thousand cuts, right? So that was also, you know, Dulles also has a, you know, very significant role in our involvement in Vietnam and Southeast Asia in that regard. So anyway, brinksmanship and massive retaliation are both aspects of this new look policy that was, you know, and new look, the vision of new look is deeply, deeply rooted in Dulles' view of the moral law. And that the moral law, like, I mean, he said his whole career as Secretary of State that the Cold War is going to be a long conflict. It's going to go on probably beyond our generation. It's not going to be over anytime soon. But and furthermore, the Cold War will not be won by material forces, by, you know, soldiers and weapons, tanks and armor and airplanes and nuclear weapons. It's ultimately not going to be won by material weapons. It is going to be won by spiritual weapons, moral weapons, the power of our example as we, you know, live by, champion, and emulate the moral law. And incidentally, Ronald Reagan, his administration, he used that language throughout his time as president. It was the spiritual weapons that were going to win the war, not material weapons. And, you know, I mean, I would say that a lot of that turned out to be correct.
Well, I see we're coming up on an hour for our conversation here, and I don't want to keep you too long. But can you give us a, unless there are any other specific details or ideas you want to bring up, I think we hit kind of the
main
points.
Yeah, we can move on.
Can you give us an overall summary of your feel for Dulles? Was he good for America, or did he escalate things to a place they didn't need to go? What's your takeaway with John Foster Dulles?
Yeah, I mean, It's a complicated – he's a complicated figure.
Sure.
Ultimately, you know, my biography of Dulles is you know, on balance, it's a sympathetic biography. And there's a method to that. There's an intention behind that.
Right.
The historiography on Dulles since the early 70s has been overwhelmingly negative. And that's one of the reasons why I was interested in him. Was he really that bad is the question that I, you know, ask. And so, you know, I set out to write this religious biography to look at another dimension of the man's life, not as the international attorney, not so much as the diplomat or the Secretary of State. Certainly those things are there. You can't get around it. But he was a man, you know, just like James says about Elijah. You know, he was a man just like us, you know. And, you know, what makes the man tick? Where did his ideas come from? What worldview do his ideas about foreign policy, where do they emerge from? So I think that Dulles, many of the things that Dulles did and represented were good for America. And I do believe, if you ask me personally, I do believe that Dulles was in the right place at the right time to advance human liberty during the early years of the Cold War, and to champion it. But on the other hand, too, you know, the man had a lot of failures. He believed, I think, too much in the mission of the United States. He had too much confidence in the innocence of the United States. He was a great deal of a religious exceptionalist in those terms, which I'm very critical of in other writings that I have, and remain so. You know, he, just like you, just like me, he's a mixed bag of paradoxes, and I talk about some of those paradoxes in my introduction to the book. He's a very paradoxical figure, and scholars on John Foster Dulles, like Richard Immerman especially, you know, he says that, you know, Dulles is a very elusive figure. It's very difficult to figure him out. And I think that's true. That's what I found. As soon as you think you've got him cornered, well, he surprises you. And that's what's interesting about him. That's what makes him fascinating.
Well, and I think that's probably a good place for us to stop, because he is fascinating, and it's a great book.
Thank you.
I encourage all of our listeners to go out and pick up God's Cold Warrior, The Life and Faith of John Foster Dulles by John Wilsey. Dr. Wilsey, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate having you here.
Thank you, Dr. Neil. I appreciate you very much.
Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.